alchemy, more than just the science of transmuting base metals into gold, creating wealth and materializing objects from a universal source of energy, alchemy is a powerful method of transforming yourself. You are not powerless. You don't have to be a victim of circumstances. You can change your life, your nation, and your planet. You can alter your destiny. Here on this show, we feature local and nationally known speakers and writers to help you begin your quest to fulfill your destiny. Welcome to Radio Alchemy. Good afternoon. This is Tony Maxwell, and I'm your host for today's program on Radio Alchemy. You're tuned to 91.3 WVUD Newark. Our guest this afternoon is author Kathy Marley. Now, asked what inspires her to write, Kathy says, "I spent a lifetime learning how to love myself. When I turned 50, it was as if I grew into my own power. My whole life's experience came together for me, and I saw everything filtered through a more positive life light than ever before. Now, it's as if the ideas that have been growing in me for years have finally ripened to the point where I have to give them life. It's a transformation that reaches to my core and demands to be shared." Our topic today is her recent book, Peeking Over the Edge, Views from Life's Middle. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tony. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Kathy, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, you know, when I got to middle age, I think it happens to a lot of us, I became very reflective, and I realized that I really wanted to leave something behind. Over and above the family that I've built, I wanted to make a positive impact on the world. I wanted to leave a legacy, if you will. And the only way that I knew to do it was to put my words on paper and share them with other people and hopefully let them become more positive individuals by the shared experience that we would have.
Now you've had a very unique background in terms of starting out and more of a conventional type of career.
I have, in fact.
And then making a transformation.
I spent a large part of my career in aerospace in a very technical position. I worked as an engineering aide for many, many years, analyzing data and running tests and doing all types of technical things. And one day I got laid off, and I came out of that, and I thought, oh, my God, what do I want to do now? And, you know, that's a major change in your life. I looked at that and I thought, okay, I could do any number of things. I had a lot of skills. I was in the process of completing a master's degree in business. So I knew that I could go out and acquire a position, you know, working for a big corporation. But that really wasn't what I wanted to do. At that point, I had spent so many years working for a big company that I knew I needed to do something that was much more individual, if you will. So I sat down with my two closest friends, and I said, okay, now what do I do? And we looked at consulting, and you know, because I had studied diversity as a part of my master's program. I was actually qualified to go out and consult in diversity management. And the more we went around and around and around, and I looked at that, and I went, no, that's not right for me. Finally, one of them said, well, Kathy, why don't you write? And it was really funny, Tony, because I laughed at that point, and I said, but Elaine, anyone can write. And she laughed at me and said, oh, no, 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 no. Proceeded to hire me on the spot to write a press release for her, which I did. We ended up on the front page of the business section in the Arizona Republic. And I thought, that was not too hard. And the rest is kind of history. At that point, I stood up and told people I was a writer, and I made it happen. It was really something that just, it was almost a to think is to create type of situation. I said, I am a writer, and therefore I was a writer.
Now, your writing style is exceptionally easy to read. I really, really enjoyed reading your book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I've had such positive feedback on my words, and I don't work them. That's the interesting thing about the way I write. The words that are on the paper are almost exactly as they came out when I sat down to write them.
Now you shared a lot. You share a lot of wisdom in your book that obviously you've gleaned through the years, and in fact, even to this point, talking about natural talents, you know, we all can see that you have this natural talent for writing, but you didn't seem to recognize that for many, many years.
I think most of us don't recognize our own natural talents. I think what happens is they are, because they are so natural to us, we look at them as being something that anyone in the world can do just as easily as we can. And so we struggle and we strive to find our true path in life when it's really right in front of us. And, you know, in my case, it was words. Other people sing. Other people dance. Other people are tremendously wonderful engineers, and they think anyone can be a good engineer, and that's not the case. I really believe that, you know, that's one of our truest callings in life, is to figure out what it is that we do so well that it overshadows everything else, and then follow that path.
Now, we talked about one of the chapters in your book is called Ripples in a Pond.
Oh, yes.
And you write some really wonderful things in that chapter. Could you maybe read something from that part of your book?
Yes, I can. We talk about, in the story, I talk about a group, again, the same two friends. We created a group, the three of us, and we called ourselves Dream Builders. And I say we called it Dream Builders. There were three of us, and we were the very best of friends, knowing each other from the heart out. We came together in mutual need, each ready to recreate some critical part of our own life. Elaine, ever practical and solidly grounded, had a clear vision of herself away from the corporate life and in a business that would impact the lives of children. Anita, our altruist, dreamed of stirring women's hearts, of inspiring them to discover their own greatness. And me, all I wanted was to find my truest life's work, some long-forgotten passion that could replace the stagnant job I had just lost to a reduction in force. And I continue on talking about how we created the rest of our lives at that point and the impact that it had on other people. One of the things that we did that came out of that was a publication called Women in Transition that Anita and I put together. And I say we freely distributed it with love to any and all comers, only trusting that it would reach the hearts that needed it. Oh, and it did find its target. We have seen the ripples it created, but we have yet to see all the shores it has touched. In its pages, one woman, my husband's assistant, found the courage to change the course of her life. At an age when many women look forward only to retirement, she chose to quit her job, return to school, and begin working with recovering addicts and AIDS patients. Years later, as I attended this woman's memorial service, I was reminded again that none of us ever knows how far the ripples will reach when we drop our pebble in the pond, what distant shores may be changed by their gentle wash. One after another, I heard of the lives this one woman had saved. In a few years she had worked with these lost souls, she had saved many, leaving them productive and peaceful for the first time in their lives. That day, I could see the ripples reaching from our dream of a simple newsletter to this extraordinary woman, then to the lives she changed, and finally to the children they now raise with love rather than neglect. Ours was but a simple dream, yet it touched souls in ever-widening circles. Surely that is a legacy worth leaving. And it goes on a little bit longer. But that Ripples in a Pond, I think, is, it talks about the legacy we leave in life And that's what this book is about. This is my legacy, at least the first one. I'm hoping to write another after this.
You have that great quote from It's a Wonderful Life just before that chapter.
Henry Travers talking to James Stewart. That's one of the things I do. Every story in the book is preceded by a quote that means a lot to me. And Henry Travers, who was the angel, says to Jimmy Stewart, he says, "Strange, isn't it? Each man's life touches so many other lives, and when he isn't around, he leaves an awful hole, doesn't he?"
It's fascinating, isn't it? And we never know at times really where the ripples have been and what kind of impact they might have made.
We don't. And, you know, I've had people come up to me and say, "Oh, my God, I look up to you so much." And I think, "Me? You look up to me." And I think it's very typical that we tend to be that way. We don't see that we're having an impact on other people. And yet that's one of the most profound things we can do in life, is to be a positive example.
Now you cover a number of topics that I think are really of universal interest to many people out there. One of the topics that you cover for several chapters is your lifelong battle with weight and self-esteem.
Yes.
Can you touch upon that?
Well, I have been terribly, terribly overweight. I have been very normal weight. It's a battle that I think women in particular struggle with. We worry about what other people think of us. In my case, I started, I remember being overweight at 13, actually at 11, and that was the first time my mother put me on a diet. I have dieted ever since. In the last few years, I lost over 100 pounds, and yet, as soon as I was under an inordinate amount of stress, I started eating again, which is very typical. Eventually, we get to a point, hopefully, where we become peaceful with who we are and not worry about how we look as much. The health is important. There's no question about that. And I think that when we become peaceful in our hearts with who we are, our weight stabilizes. That's what's happened with me.
You have this great chapter in the book where you say that, "I finally recognized that the important thing was not the shape I showed, but the shape I was in."
Mm-hmm.
"And I finally understood that health was the most important thing and looks secondary."
That's correct.
Really nice to write that.
Well, and I think it's something that, you know, so many women in particular are so obsessed with how they look that we neglect looking at our own hearts and coming to peace with ourselves. We spend so much time paddling down the stream, or up the stream, if you will, trying to be perfect and trying to look perfect and trying to fit in with everybody else in the world, that we don't recognize that what we are is ideal and what we are is perfect right now. It's interesting because living in the Southwest, one of the things that I have discovered, and I may be speaking completely incorrectly, but I've interacted with a number of Native American women who are, you know, overweight. And what I see is this incredible shining spirit and a total acceptance of where they are and what they are each moment. The Native American women I've interacted with don't obsess about their looks. They don't obsess about their body. They are more concerned with their own spirit, which I think becomes a critical thing in life.
Yes, interesting. And that one chapter on transformations, you also talked about the fact that eventually, as you became more positive and accepting of your shape, that you stopped worrying about what others thought of you.
That's correct.
That in reality, many people probably don't think of your failings as often as you thought they did.
Absolutely. And most people don't think of us as often as we think they think of us. Mm. They're too busy thinking of themselves. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's just the way human beings are. And one of the things that I've discovered almost universally is that the older we get, the more true that becomes, that we really give less concern to what other people are thinking as we get older. And thank God. That's all I can say is thank God.
Well, you have to introduce Sissy now.
Oh, Sissy.
Yes.
Oh, she was... when I was, I guess I was 10, I had this obsession, if you will, and it started in the summertime. I went to the local toy store, which, of course, was close to home, and all of us kids would walk down there or ride our bicycles down there, and we'd go in the toy store and dream and make lists for Christmas and things like that. Well, I walked in one day, and there was this doll sitting on a shelf. And the story goes, her name was Sissy. To my little girl eyes, she was the most exquisite thing I had ever seen. Tall and brunette, with a perfectly formed woman's body, complete with slender waist and perfectly proportioned breasts. She was clad in entrancingly crisp white organza, the long full skirt trimmed in tiny red roses and lace. The entire outfit complemented perfectly by bright red high-heeled sandals. She was grace, beauty, poise, womanhood at its best. And I go on in the story to talk about how I dreamed that that was the only thing I wanted for Christmas that year. I begged my parents over and over, and I remember on Christmas Eve, by Christmas Eve, I was sobbing in my father's arms, convinced Santa would never bring her for me. After all, she was much too expensive. You see, we were far from wealthy, and in 1955, $20 was an exorbitant sum for a mere doll. Still on Christmas morning, there she was under the tree, a luminous testament to the truth of Santa Claus and the love of two parents who made a child's dream come true. It was a magical Christmas, lightly slipping treasures of memory into my waiting heart, storing them away to later remind me of forgotten love, dreams come true, and the simple joys of childhood. But after that Christmas, I eventually got to a point where I didn't want dolls anymore, and I put Sissy away, and I kind of lost track of her for several years. And then one day, well into my own middle age, I found Sissy again. With little thought for what she had meant to me, I had casually stored her away in a box in a storeroom on our farm. After years in that dusty room with its tiny, sharp-toothed predators, she was a very sorry sight indeed. Bald and naked, with fingers chewed away, a large crack in her head, and lashes long gone from her lovely eyes, she was still recognizable to my heart. So I took Sissy, and I had her repaired, and I had her dress remade, and I say, as heartbroken at the ravages I had allowed, I wrapped her broken figure in a soft towel and carried her to a nearby doll hospital where we found a wig to cover her baldness and broken head. It wasn't quite the same sassy, dark brown style she had worn in her newness, but somehow its new upswept look was fitting for her restoration in middle age. I go on to talk about how I replaced her dress, and I replaced, I couldn't fix her fingers, and I couldn't find any high heels. And what I say is, even though I searched everywhere, I was never able to replace her shiny red shoes. But it doesn't seem such a great loss that she is barefoot in her later years. Perhaps shiny red high heels are best relegated to the young anyway. I believe the new Sissy has far more character than the original. In her youth, she was an almost impossible ideal. Today, she wears her life proudly, fingers and all, content in what she has become, as am I. We may no longer be the epitome of grace and youthful beauty, but we are still womanhood at its best, serene in a life lived fully and content with the marks it has left upon our bodies and our souls. With that, who needs red high heels? And I don't wear high heels anymore. I gave those up a while back. So
I really enjoyed
Sissy
that story.
Was a symbol for me. She sits in my library right now with her new hairstyle and her missing fingers and her missing eyelashes. And you know what? She's still as precious to me as she ever was.
Yeah. And I love the whole attitude and perspective that she has more character now than she did when she just came into your life.
Don't we all? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, put a few marks of time on our face, and my God, we have to. We become so much more interesting as we get older. At least I think so.
We're talking to Kathy Marley. The topic is Peeking Over the Edge, Views from Life's Middle. My name is Tony Maxwell. It's like a short break. We'll be back in a minute. This is 91.3 WVUD Newark, the voice of the University of Delaware. You're listening to Radio Alchemy, motivational speeches and conversation to help you fulfill your destiny. Welcome back to Radio Alchemy. I'm Tony Maxwell, and our guest today is Kathy Marley. The topic, her recent book, Peeking Over the Edge, Views from Life's Middle. One of the chapters that I thought was quite good was your views on hero worship.
Yes, absolutely.
And there's so many heroes in our country, that especially in the sports arena, that we think of. And yet, in the very end, somehow things fall apart. All the time, every time we look at these great heroes. But there has to be a different perspective.
Well, you know, Tony, I think everyone has, in some way or another, has feet of clay, for lack of a better term to put on it. We all have our warts that we hide behind our clothes and our masks. And sometimes no one ever sees them. I look at our heroes, our sports heroes, and I think, you know, they have to put their pants on one leg at a time. They are not perfect. We put them up on a pedestal, and we look at them, and we expect them, whether they're sports heroes or politicians, we expect them to be perfect and to have absolutely no flaws whatsoever. And the fact of the matter is, if they're human beings, they will have flaws. In hero worship, I looked at my sister, and I looked up to her for as long as I can remember. You know, she was several years older than I and is, and she was always what I wanted to be. I studied German in high school because she had studied German. I decided to major in math in college because she was a math major. I wanted to program computers because she programmed computers. I did what so many young people today tend to do. We look at the person we idolize, whether it's Madonna or President Bush, or pick someone else, and we look at those people and we think, that's what I want to be. I want to be that. And so we do everything we can to emulate that person. And we, as a result, we don't become ourselves. We negate what's really inside our own heart. And it wasn't until I started separating myself from my own sister, who was my idol, that I was able to start walking my own path and give credence to the fact that I could write where she couldn't. She could do math. I'm okay at it, but I'm not a major mathematician in life. And I idolized this woman so completely that I couldn't see that she had her own set of problems. And it wasn't until she came crashing down off that pedestal that I recognized that we could stand together and we could be much stronger if we were each our own selves. And, you know, where I had strengths, she had weaknesses. Where she had strengths, I had weaknesses, and we held each other up. And that's what life is all about. If we spend our entire lives trying to be someone else, we never become ourselves. And that's our purpose, to become who we're meant to be, not who someone else is.
In one of the other chapters that I thought is kind of goes hand in hand with this is you talk about a perfect life.
Yes.
And everybody has this vision of what the perfect life will be, and it kind of changes as the years go by and so forth. And somehow, life just doesn't turn out the way you expected, and yours did not.
Oh, no, not at all. Absolutely not. I had this vision that I would have children who were intelligent and dressed like little preppies and college educated and loved to read and loved classical music and art, and I could take them to museums and we could do things together in that regard. That wasn't meant to be. I fell in love with someone who already had three children. And when I married him, I made the decision not to have children of my own. And so I took on his three. And at the time we got married, the oldest was 16, the next one down was 14, and the next one down was 12. And surprisingly enough, the boys were not preppies. The boys were cowboys. And our daughter was a tomboy. She didn't like dolls and dresses. And I had to recognize that what I had to do was accept them for who they are. The perfect life just doesn't ever exist. It's a fantasy. Life can go well, and it goes a lot better if we accept the people around us for who they are without putting expectations on them. And I'm hoping, and what's interesting is that over the years, slowly but surely, all three of them have started to come around a little bit closer to what my dream was. But it wasn't going to happen until I accepted them for who they were. And now all of a sudden they're reading, and they're coming to me for advice, and they're wanting to go to the theater, and they're wanting to hear music that they never listened to before. Now, is that because they're adults now? Maybe. But I'd like to believe it has something to do with me.
Right. Right. You're accepting them as they grew up.
Absolutely.
Now, I understand that you're also a pack rat.
Oh, terrible. Absolutely. I have books that go back to, oh, my God, Nancy Drew, Black Beauty.
Wow.
I have books from when I was a very small child. I don't throw books away. That's just a part of it. The other day I happened to realize that for some strange reason I started collecting boxes. Didn't realize I was collecting boxes. I just had boxes. And they're cool boxes. I mean, they're really neat boxes. But, and what I think it is, it's the mystery of what could be inside a box. I collect frogs. And that's another whole big long story we don't even need to go into. Also, one of the stories in the book talks about Bungie, who's one of my frogs, and he's full of life and smiles and laughs and jumps out into the unknown with his arms out wide. Yeah, I collect a lot of stuff. What I've discovered, though, Tony, is that the more stuff I collect around myself, it's almost like insulating myself from the world. So slowly but surely, I'm starting to let go of a lot of it and get rid of it because I feel like, you know, it's much lighter to work that way.
Right. Right. Now, in that particular discussion, you not only talk about being a pack rat, but that that many of us are emotional pack rats.
Oh, absolutely.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
We hold on to the feelings, good and bad. And unfortunately, we tend to hang on to the bad ones often more than we hold on to the good ones. And we don't understand why we get cynical, don't understand why our hearts are heavy. And it isn't until we can let go of those emotional baggage, if you will, that we can lighten up our own load. It's a sad thing to me to see people who are so immersed in what happened 50 years ago or 30 years ago or 5 years ago. They're so immersed in it that they can't live today. And sometimes all you have to do is just let go of it and get on and look at the future. Don't look at what happened in the past, because the past is past. It's over. You can't change it. All you can do is just learn to live with it and keep right on going.
I'm sure many of us have heard before the adage that the windshield is a lot bigger than your rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and there's a good reason for that.
There is a definite reason for that.
And speaking about being in the moment and letting go, you have this chapter called The Right Age. And so Oprah's quote is, the breathe, let go, and remind yourself that this very moment is the only one you know you have for sure.
It is. It is the absolute only moment you've got. So why not just say that, okay, if I'm 12, 12 is what's good. If I'm 60, 60 is good. I certainly believe that that I would much rather be 60 than dead.
Mm. So there is no right age?
There is never a right age. The right age is what you are right this minute. If I focus on what I was at 20, I never learned to enjoy what I am at 60. And if you learn to accept right now as the right age, you can live your life completely. You can live it fully. This is the minute. This is the only minute that matters, is right this minute. Tomorrow's going to take care of itself one way or the other. And yesterday is long gone. And if you allow yesterday to control where you are now, you don't live it. You don't live this minute. So I'm going to live every stretch of it that I can.
And, based on the book, you really do live your life.
Thank you. I like to believe I do. There are some days that I look at it and I think, no. Life is not as great as I like it to believe. And you know what? Those moments pass. Thank God they pass.
In sort of a subsequent chapter, you talk about the elephant in the house.
Yes.
And you describe the whole issue of the fact that that we all fear losing someone that that we love.
Yes.
And even though we know that losing them would be unbearably painful, that you couldn't learn to live with the fear and not let it control your life. And that... if we don't manage the elephants in our lives, we're in fact exacerbating the fear in others that we love.
That's true. The story you're talking about, Tony, deals with the fact that I kept gaining more and more and more weight, and I kept thinking, this is my problem, it's not someone else's problem. And what I didn't see was that and holding on to all those excess pounds, all I was doing was making the people who love me fear for my life. And it wasn't until I almost lost my husband that I realized how worried he was about me. And it's amazing when you shift your perspective, just that little tweak, the difference it can make in how you live your life. I think we all have elephants in our home. You know, for some of us, it's our weight. For some of us, it's what we choose to not see. It's what we hold on to that is hurting other people around us. And for me, when I realized that by holding on to that weight, I was so seriously scaring the people who love me. All of a sudden, I realized I can't consciously let myself keep hurting these people that way. I'll do something about this.
So that elephant could be high blood pressure. It could be cholesterol.
It could be cholesterol, it could be alcoholism, it can be anything that is self-destructive, where we sit back and say, well, I'm not hurting anyone but me. And so as long as I'm only hurting myself, who cares? But that is such a self-centered perspective, because even when we're doing something that hurts us, and we say, oh, it's okay with me because I'm only hurting myself, we don't see that we're hurting other people. It's like the person who commits suicide and doesn't think about the fact that they are leaving their loved ones behind to grieve and suffer. And I mean, the suicide, that's an extreme way of looking at it, but it's when you really come down to it, it's pretty much the same thing. We may be only physically hurting ourselves, but emotionally we're damaging the people who love us. Mm. And they don't know what to do to help. And so, you know, if we truly love, we care about what we do to other people through what we do to ourselves.
Now, Kathy, when do people stop singing and stop dancing?
Pardon me?
When do people stop singing or stop dancing?
When we reach a point where someone says, why are you doing that? And we take on the criticism. When we believe more about what other people tell us than what we believe in ourselves, when we let that control the joy that we have inside. In my case, I stopped singing when I had a boyfriend one day, and we had been out, and we'd had a wonderful time, and we came back, and I was singing softly, and he snarled at me and told me I couldn't carry a tune. I quit singing right then. And it took me years to get over what I had allowed that man to put on to me. It wasn't his fault in the long run. It was what I accepted. We quit singing when we allow what other people say or do to us to control how we feel about ourselves. When it really comes down to it, the only one who's responsible is you. And you can choose. And life is a choice from beginning to end. We can choose to be happy, or we can choose to be unhappy. We can choose to sing, we can choose to be mute. And I've heard people say, oh, well, it's so-and-so's fault because they told me this and they did this to me. No, it's my fault because I allowed what they said to control how I feel about myself. It really comes down to it. The only one I'm responsible for, that's responsible for how I feel, is me. We quit singing and we quit dancing when we become so overly concerned about what other people say and what other people think.
It wouldn't be nice if, and you talk about this in your book as well, if all of us could, if it was acceptable for adults to behave more like children once in a while, and sing and dance in a way that we wouldn't be so self-conscious about what others
think. Go to Disneyland.
Yes. So you celebrated your 50th birthday, right?
I did celebrate my 50th birthday at Disneyland, as a matter of fact. It was a situation where we thought, okay, my husband said, oh, this is a huge, big birthday for you. What do you want to do? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, we could go to Las Vegas. And I said, been there, done that. And he said, well, we could have, I said, I'd love a surprise party, but, you know, the minute you tell somebody you want a surprise party, it's not a surprise anymore.
That's right.
It really isn't. And I just happened to be looking through, I don't know, a magazine or something, and I spotted an ad for Disneyland, and I went, that's it. I hadn't been to Disneyland since I was 26 years old. And I said, that's what I want to do, go to Disneyland. And we did. We had so much fun. We started early in the day. We stayed up late. We ate junk food. We ate room service at night. We rode the rides. We screamed. We yelled. And we were surrounded by people who were having a good time. And it's amazing how much younger I felt when I came home. I think that was the magic.
We're talking to Kathy Marley. The topic, Peeking Over the Edge, Views from Life's Middle. My name is Tony Maxwell. Let's take a short break. We'll be back in a minute. This is 91.3 WVUD Newark, the voice of the University of Delaware. You're listening to Radio Alchemy, motivational speeches and conversation to help you fulfill your destiny. Back to Radio Alchemy. I'm Tony Maxwell, and our guest today is Kathy Marley. The topic, the release of her book, Peeking Over the Edge, Views from Life's Middle. What I thought we'd do is talk a little bit about your viewpoint on simple abundance, on what it means to be truly rich to you.
Oh, dear. To me, being rich is appreciating every moment of life. It's living in joy. It's appreciating what you have right this minute and not coveting what everyone else has. I grew up with a cousin who was significantly better off than I was. We were middle class. She was pretty well-to-do. So she had all the dancing lessons and the pretty toys and all that stuff, and I envied that. And then I reached a point at some point where I looked at other friends and I thought, oh my God, she has more boyfriends than I've got. Oh, this person has this wonderful laugh. And I spent so many years wanting to be that. And then I started accumulating things. And I mean things. It goes back to that pack rat thing. And I kept thinking that the more I had, the more wealthy I would be, because I had looked at other people and thought, oh, if I had what so-and-so's got, I would be better. I would be richer. And I discovered through really looking at the people who were, again, the ones I was measuring myself against, I realized that even though they were rich in dollars, a lot of times they were not rich in spirit. I really believe, and I say it in the book, true abundance comes from deep inside the soul. And it's linked to an appreciation of small joys, with giving, with receiving. It's linked to your love of your family and your friends. the bottom line that's appreciating life as it is right this very minute. And I mean, that means if you hurt, appreciate the hurt a little bit. Recognize that where you are is good right this minute. It could be worse. Yeah, it could be better, maybe. But if we truly appreciate the relationships, the love, the positive things that are going on in life, the negative things don't have the power to control us. And I guess that's what I'm grateful for, is that true abundance of beauty, of love, of family, of being appreciated.
Do you still read romance novels?
Not very often. I try to avoid those. Dissatisfied with life when I do. And when I say that, you're laughing, you know. Basically, what happens when I read romance novels is I see a world that is so perfect. I mean, you see these men who are, you know, they have washboard abs and they have broad bronze chests and women with flowing raven tresses. And I look at myself and I go, I am not that. And I look at my husband and I think, and he's not that. And you read these stories and they have this wild, rampaging passion going on. And I look at my relationship with my husband and I think, and it's not that. And so the stories tend to leave me a little dissatisfied. And yet, and I really want that. You know, it's like I read those and I'm like, yeah, I want that. I really want to be that. And I really want what those people have got. And then I sit back and I look at my husband and I think, you know what? He may not be the perfect hero, but he is mine. And he's the one I chose. Not because he's perfect and not because he has washboard abs, but because when he looks at me, I feel warm inside. And because I know that he loves me. And you know what? I look at that heroine, and I look at that hero in the book, and I think, you know what? Those people, give them about 35 or 40 years, and they're going to be right where I am right this minute. No matter how perfect things are for them right now, one of these days they're going to be a little older too, just like their parents.
I remember years ago in college days, this great Russian professor that I had in this Russian literature course who used to ask the question, how many of you are preparing to live, or how much time do you spend preparing to live, and how much time do you spend living? And, you know, I think I spent probably the first, 35 years of life, like, preparing to live.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mm-hmm. probably only been the last five or seven years that I really feel that I've started to actually spend more time actually living it. So when is someday?
Someday is right now. It's today. It's not tomorrow. It's today. It's the time that we live. It's grabbing the moment, if you will. It's being here now. I looked at life and I thought, you know what? Someday we're going to be perfect. Someday we're going to have everything we could ever want. Someday we'll have all the time in the world to travel and to play and to do what we want. And you know what? Someday could go away just in the snap of a finger. And so you have to treasure right this minute. You have to treasure what you have. Take advantage of it. Don't lose it. You recognize that the little things are what really matter in life. Holding hands, having someone put their arms around you and say, I love you. Spending a moment doing something that you passionately adore doing, in my case, writing. Maybe in someone else's case, it's spending time with their children. Maybe it's, you know, taking a minute to hold a cat in your lap and pet it and listen to it purr. Playing frisbee with your dog. It's that minute that counts. It's not all of the things that you think you're going to do someday, because someday's going to happen right this minute. It may never come. This could be the last day of your life. Grab it. Use it. Love it. What was the movie? Dead Poets Society?
Dead Poets Society, yes. Carpe diem, right?
Grab the moment right now.
That was one of my favorite movies. Actually, it was parts of it were filmed right here in the Wilmington, Delaware.
Oh, really?
Yes.
It was a great film.
Yes, I think it was. And now, you know, we're not too far away from the holiday season, Kathy. How do you, and you have this great perspective on holidays, and we get caught in the commercialization of it, I guess. And but how do we learn to appreciate the holidays?
Grab the Christmas angel. Let her touch your heart.
I need one of those. I don't have one of those.
She really is. We have to recognize that the holidays are a time to look at what's good inside. There are, like you say, Tony, there is so much commercialism that goes on around the holidays. I get to a point with Christmas quite often where I look at the, you know, the fact that August they're selling Christmas trees at the local Michael's store, and I think, oh my God, is it ever going to stop being so early? And then I start putting all the I have to's on myself. Well, I have to get the Christmas list, you know, written. I have to go out and shop. I have to get the cards and blah, 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 blah. And we have to let go of that and start looking at the real joy and the warmth that's around us. And I think of that as the time of the Christmas angel. She looks at us and she looks at the magic and she tosses it in front of us and says, look, 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 take a look at what's around you here. And if you take a minute and you stop and you look in the mall, look at the children looking at Santa Claus. There's the magic of Christmas right there. Those children, and you know, I don't care if they're Christian or not Christian, they see that as a picture of all that's exciting and mysterious. And boy, is it nice to touch into that. You know, to look at their faces and just see what they're doing, to take a look at the beauty around us, look at the Christmas lights, you know, look at the spirit of oneness that takes place at that time of year. I think, you know, I love Salvation Army bells. I love Santa Claus. I love cinnamon and bayberry and pine and chocolate. And, you know, that's the holidays for me. The thing is, we just have to be open to look at the love, the forgiveness, the compassion, the magic of the whole season. If we can touch into that, we can let go of the commercialism.
You have this beautiful little chapter on the benefits of smiling.
That was an interesting day when I wrote that story. I was driving down the street and I saw a woman walking down the street, and she looked pretty ragged, probably was homeless, and yet she had this beaming smile. And there was nobody around. I mean, she was just walking down the street smiling, and it caught my attention because it was so unusual. One would be no reason, no obvious reason, just smiling. I like to think about what she was thinking about that day. The problem is we go through life and we're so serious that we forget to smile. And if every single one of us were to smile at someone else just because, or smile to ourselves just because, I really think it would be infectious. I think it would pass on to the next person, if you will. And we might lighten up a little bit of life.
Yes.
I guess that's the thing. I like to keep my spirits light as much as I can. I think that it makes a true difference in the whole perspective we have on life.
I always tell people there's the story of my mother who passed on a number of years ago, and she had trouble seeing. She really couldn't see long distances because of a cataracts and so forth, and needed to get some surgery and so forth. So I took her to a doctor's office in a place where she would never visit on a regular basis, and walked into the waiting area, and she threw up this beautiful big smile. Everybody in the waiting room looked up, saw my mother smiling, and they all painted a smile on her face. They said hello. It was like everybody knew her, and I know they didn't.
It transforms people. It truly does. You can feel the energy of a genuine smile. It's like having the sunshine on you. And what a tremendous story that is, and how perfectly that exemplifies what I'm saying. You know, the smile just, it really affects people around you. And yeah, it can make life so much better. I mean, we have, like I said earlier, we have a choice. We can walk through life grumping and gloomy, or we can let go of it and just turn around and smile and say, you know what? It could be a heck of a lot worse, so we might as well enjoy what we've got right this minute, and let's smile at it.
So how does it feel peeking over the edge, Kathy?
Gremlins! I hit 50, and I thought to myself, oh, boy. You know, it's all over. I'm over the hill, if you will. And the whole story, Peeking Over the Edge, in the book really talks about it's just kind of a metaphor for middle age, if you will. I sat on the top of that hill, and I looked behind me, and I looked at all the dreams I had tossed behind and the regrets of the things I had left undone. And I really did not want all the good things in life to be over. But as I said, I had a choice. I was sitting up there, and I could choose to let life be over. Or I could turn around and peek around on the other side of the hill. And that's one of the things I say. In the book, I say, I felt much like those cowboys in the old Western movies. You know the ones. Often when they reach the past, they're running from something. Same time, they're running to something. And even though they have a pretty good idea of what lies ahead, they still climb to the top of the hill and, keeping a low profile, peek over there cautiously to check the other side. Well, I did that. I sat up there and I took a little peek over the side to see what was on the second half of life. And I was really surprised, because what I saw was possibilities. I didn't really start writing until I was 50. And I don't know if that was because I was starting to tap into a lifetime of knowledge. I've heard it said that we become wiser as we get older. I'd like to believe that. I looked behind me, I looked at all of the things I had let go, and I thought I could hold on to the regrets of the things I have not done in my life. Or I can skip over the top and join the fairies over there who were collecting all of my dreams and saying they're still possible. And so basically I took a little step over the top of the hill and kept right on going. And believe me, it's a limitless possibility that's on the other side of that hill.
In your book, you explore a lot of different areas. We've already talked about weight and self-esteem, but you also discuss various different areas such as love, family, and stepmothering. Mm-hmm. You talk about things such as tolerance and kinship and coming into your own power. And again, as we've been talking about over this last hour, the insight and the expanded awareness that come with age. Now, Kathy, how can our listeners get a copy of this book? And how can they get in contact with you?
They can reach me through my website, which is very simple. It's just my name. It's C-A-T-H-Y Marley, M-A-R-L-E-Y, .com. They can reach me that way. They can order a book directly from me if they would like to have it signed. If they want, they can also order it through my publisher, which is Infinity Publishing. Their website is BBOTW, buybooksontheweb.com. And they can reach it through Amazon. It's not available in Barnes & Noble or Borders, any of the major bookstores, but they can actually go into the major bookstore and ask for it, and they should be able to find it. Certainly, if they can't find it, I want to know that.
And again, just the how can they get a hold of you, Kathy?
They can reach me at kathymarley.com, kathymarley.com. That's the easiest way to find me, is just directly. It goes kathymarley.com, and that will get me.
Kathy, thank you very much for being our guest today.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking to Kathy Marley on the topic, the release of her book, Peeking Over the Edge, Views from Life's Middle. We hope you enjoyed today's show. Stay tuned for Sunday afternoon selections.